Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon, and today I will read three poems that shine the spotlight on three different individuals known for their musical talents, as well as the controversy they provoked. The title for today's show, Three Controversial Musicians. Back in 1952, by orders of the State Department, singer Paul Robeson was prohibited from leaving the country. His crime? He was vocal in his opposition to racism, his calls for civil rights, and that prompted our federal government to consider him dangerous. Imagine that. Rather than the State Department trying to deport him, Robeson was the victim of a kind of reverse immigration policy. Also, though not a member of the American Communist Party, he had refused to deny he was a communist. During the dreary days of the McCarthy era, J. Edgar Hoover placed many Americans under suspicion for their political beliefs and acted quickly to deny them their rights. In May of 1952, Robeson was prevented from entering Canada. So, in defiance, he held an outdoor concert at the International Peace Arch on the border between Canada and the U.S. in Blaine, Washington. In fact, he performed on a primitive stage right at the border crossing from the United States to Canada. The Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shihab Nye memorialized that concert in her poem, Cross That Line. Paul Robeson stood on the northern border of the USA and sang into Canada, where a vast audience sat on folding chairs waiting to hear him. He sang into Canada. His voice left the USA when his body was not allowed to cross that line. Remind us again, brave friend, what countries may we sing into? What lines should we all be crossing? What songs travel toward us from far away to deepen our days? Naomi Shihab Nye crossed that line. In Blaine, Washington, the site of Robeson's defiant concert, he sang for tens of thousands of audience members on the back of a pickup. A pianist accompanied his strong voice. The poem opens with four simple declarative statements, and Naomi Shihab Nye ends with three open-ended questions directed at us, her audience, questions she wants us to reflect on. What lines should we all be crossing? The poem asks. This poem appears in a 2011 volume. Naomi Shihab Nye must presume her questions remained relevant then, almost 60 years after Robeson's concert, and you may agree their value is heightened today. To extrapolate, should we allow politicians to define those who live outside our borders, or how we should treat these so-called outsiders? Nye labels Paul Robeson brave friend. Obviously, she endorses his unique way to challenge the federal government, and of course she approves of his efforts to please his large audience. What lines should we all be crossing? Nye challenges us. For all of us who cannot sing like Paul Robeson and who cannot hold the attention of a cross-border audience, that is, for everyone who hears this poem, how might we expand our cultural boundaries? The poem questions us about songs that originate outside our national boundaries, songs that deepen our days. Implicitly, Nye urges us to recognize the positive, challenging influences offered by music we know from outside our borders, and songs we might try to become familiar with. At his show on the Washington-Canadian border in Blaine, Robeson sang peace songs from Russia, China, and Africa, along with spirituals, gospel songs, and the pro-union song Joe Hill. He closed the show with his signature song from the musical Showboat, Old Man River. He altered the song's final verse. This is what he sang. I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And Old Man River, he'll just keep rolling along. Let's hear Naomi Shihab Nye's poem once more. Paul Robeson stood on the northern border of the USA and sang into Canada, where a vast audience sat on folding chairs waiting to hear him. He sang into Canada. His voice left the USA when his body was not allowed to cross that line. Remind us again, brave friend, what countries may we sing into? What lines should we all be crossing? What songs travel toward us from far away to deepen our days? Naomi Shihab Nye's Cross That Line. This poet was the Poetry Foundation's Young People's Poet Laureate from 2019 to 2022. Many of Shihab Nye's poems, like this one, seem directed at both a young audience and adults. There's a straightforwardness to Cross That Line, a lack of complex metaphors for us to unpack. Robeson's voice drew such an immense audience to his minimalist concert in Blaine. He was the son of a man born into slavery who escaped as a teen to the North via the Underground Railroad. Robeson's father and the singer himself understood border crossings. We'll move from a massive outdoor concert in Washington State in 1952 to a small nightclub in New York City in 1959. In his autobiographically based poem, The Day Lady Died, Frank O'Hara meanders in Manhattan during his lunch break. It's a Friday, July 17, 1959, as the poem tells us indirectly. He's perplexed in a state of quandariness, as he says, about his goal to purchase a few modest gifts to bring to his host who have invited him to East Hampton for the weekend. This is one of O'Hara's I Do This, I Do That poems. It was included in his appropriately titled volume, Lunch Poems. Why am I including the lunchtime poem in an episode about musicians? Well, both the title and the poem's closing will give us an answer. This is Frank O'Hara's The Day Lady Died. It's 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it's 1959, and I go get a shoe shine, because I will get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15, and then go straight to dinner, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I walk up the muggy street beginning to sun, and have a hamburger and a malted, and buy an ugly New World writing to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go on to the bank, and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda I once heard, doesn't even look up my balance for once in her life. And in the Golden Griffin, I get a little Verlaine for Patsy, with drawings by Bonnard, although I do think of Hesiod, trans Richmond Lattimore, or Brendan Behan's new play, or Le Balcon, or Les Nigres of Genet, but I don't. I stick with Verlaine, after practically going to sleep with quandariness. And for Mike, I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and ask for a bottle of Strega, and then I go back where I came from to 6th Avenue and the Tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater, and casually ask for a carton of Gauloises and a carton of Picayune and a New York Post with her face on it. And I'm sweating a lot by now and thinking of leaning on the John Doerr in the 5-spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron and everyone, and I stopped breathing. Frank O'Hara's The Day Lady Died. The closing lines carry us out of this July afternoon. The speaker, O'Hara himself, is transported to an earlier time when he was among other breathless clubgoers enthralled by an unscheduled performance by Billie Holiday, Lady Day. The prompt for this sudden, time-stopping memory? He sees a newsstand and a New York Post with her face on it, announcing the troubled singer's death earlier that day at a mere 44 years of age. Holiday's personal fame launched in 1939 when she first performed Strange Fruit, a most serious song responding to the terroristic evil of lynching still carried out in the South at that time. That same year, she co-wrote God Bless the Child, that song with ambiguous lyrics depicting, at one level, the tension between a mother and child over personal finances. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. Not long before Holiday died, O'Hara visited the Five Spot Club to hear a friend read poetry while accompanied by the pianist Mal Waldron. Waldron also played with Holiday. Holiday happened to show up at this poetry reading. She was encouraged to sing, a violation of the law, as she was prohibited at that time from singing in bars due to her arrest for heroin use. O'Hara's poet friend recalled, "It was very close to the end of her life, with her voice almost gone, just like a whisper, just like the taste of very old wine, but full of spirit. She sang in this whispery, beautiful voice." That explanation adds some context for O'Hara's final verse. This poem names the East Hampton friends O'Hara will stay with that weekend, the authors and even a translator of books he considers buying, the brand names of the cigarettes from France and New Orleans he purchases, even the name of his bank teller, yet he never names Billie Holiday directly. The title, the date, 3 days after Bastille Day in 1959, the reference to pianist Mal Waldron, all tip us off. The majority of the poem deals with the ephemeral, a typical summer lunch hour. But O'Hara seems to recall everything, including the most mundane, his shoe shine, to mark what suddenly became a historic occasion, for him at least, the day he learned of the death of the famous singer whose whispering voice provoked his breathless response. Before I read the poem once more, I'll identify some curious features you would quickly detect if you had a printed copy of the O'Hara poem in front of you. When itemizing the choice of gifts he considers bringing with him on the train to East Hampton, he says, "I do think of Hesiod, trans Richmond Lattimore." That is, the ancient Greek poet Hesiod, author of Works and Days, in its translation by Richmond Lattimore. O'Hara abbreviates the term translator, and so I honor his casual choice. More importantly, there are no periods used in this lengthy poem, no end stops. There are only five commas. O'Hara is hyper stingy with his punctuation. That means he leaves it up to me to determine when to pause after a phrase. True, he inserts a comma after identifying the cigarettes he buys. His comma gently sets off the final 4.5 lines that shift from his account of his meanderings to seeing Billie Holiday's face in the New York Post, which triggers his memory of the last time he was in the audience for her spontaneous performance. When Holiday whispered a song, did Mal Waldron and everyone and O'Hara himself stop breathing? Or just Frank O'Hara alone, thinking, maybe, she was singing just to him? Now, Let's hear the poem once more. Frank O'Hara's The Day Lady Died. It is 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it's 1959, and I go get a shoe shine, because I will get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15, and then go straight to dinner, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I walk up the muggy street beginning to sun, and have a hamburger and a malted, and buy an ugly New World writing to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go on to the bank, and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda, I once heard, doesn't even look up my balance for once in her life. And in the Golden Griffin, I get a little Verlaine for Patsy with drawings by Bonnard. Although I do think of Hesiod, Trans Richmond Lattimore, or Brendan Behan's new play, or Le Balcon, or Les Nigres of Genet, but I don't. I stick with Verlaine after practically going to sleep with Quandariness. And for Mike, I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and ask for a bottle of Strega, and then I go back where I came from to 6th Avenue and the tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater, and casually ask for a carton of Goluas and a carton of Picayune, and a New York Post with her face on it. And I'm sweating a lot by now, and thinking of leaning on the John Doerr in the 5-spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron and everyone, and I stopped breathing. Frank O'Hara's The Day a Lady Died. Curiously, there's a link between Holiday and Robeson. The government tried to silence both, though the motives for Robeson were blatantly political. The poet William Matthews takes his reader to the New York club The Half Note in May of 1960. Matthews gives us an audience member's close-up view in his poem Mingus at the Half Note. Charles Mingus played upright bass, sometimes piano, composed music, and in this 1960 setting, he's the band leader trying to maintain control. In his late 30s at the time, Mingus is not a cranky old man, but an angry middle-aged man known for erupting at times at his fellow musicians or at audience members who distracted him. The speaker of Matthew's poem silently witnesses an interaction with a rude audience member at this New York City club. This is Mingus at the Half Note by William Matthews. 2 dozen bars or so into Better Get It In Your Soul, the band Mossy with Sweat, May 1960 at the Half Note, the rain on the black streets outside dusted here and there by the pale pollen of the streetlights. Blue wreaths of smoke, the excited calm of the hip in congregation, the long night before us like a view, and Danny Richmond so strung out the drums fizz and seethed. Ho, ho, hold it, Mingus shouts, and the band clatters to fraught silence. There's a twinge in the pianist's shoulder, but this time Mingus focuses like a nozzle his surge of imprecations on a sleek black man bent chattering across a table to his lavish date. This is your heritage, and if you don't want to listen, then you got someplace else you'd better be. The poor jerk takes a few beats to realize he'll have to leave while we all watch before another note gets played. He glowers dimly at Mingus, like throwing a rock at a cliff, then offers his date a disdained arm, and they leave in single file, she's first, and don't look back nor at each other. Don't let me constrain you, revelers, Mingus says, and then, tamed by his own rage, for now, he kick-starts the band. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Mingus at the Half Note by William Matthews. Matthew's speaker describes the severe scolding delivered from the stage. He neither endorses nor critiques this outburst. You and I get to judge Mingus's behavior. The poem's first two sentences set the scene. We know the song the band's playing, that it's raining outside the club, and inside, Mingus's band is, quotes, mossy with sweat. William Matthews adds some gentle mockery of the audience he's a member of. He feels, quotes, the excited calm of the hip in congregation. The second sentence ends with a description of the drummer, so strung out the drums fizz and seethe. If I had not told you the poem's tension emerges from an interaction with the rude audience member, you might have thought Mingus will lash out at the drummer for performing while drugged. But that's not what happens. And presumably strung out is not meant as a reference to drug use, as Mingus, very demanding of his band members, played with this drummer for many years. I don't know that he would have tolerated any habitual drug use by any of his band members. A Mingus biographer said this particular drummer was, quotes, an indispensable ingredient of the Mingus sound. Matthews allows us to hear Mingus. First, he shouts, ho, ho, hold it, and the band abruptly goes silent. I presume the speaker, William Matthews himself, a young man at age 17 in 1960, would have felt uneasy at this abrupt pause, anticipating an outburst from the stage. There's a twinge in the pianist's shoulder, the poem asserts. Does this pianist fear he will be the object of the wrath of Mingus? Second, Mingus lectures an audience member whose chatter has distracted him. Third, Mingus offers a cynical, dismissive farewell to the disruptive man. And finally, he calls to his bandmates to resume playing. The poem blends description of setting, a keen reporter's eye on the tension in the room, and Mingus's own voice that allows him to regain control of his performance. We learn about the reverence Mingus held for the bass instrument in another Matthews poem. So much accumulated energy lives inside its wood, and, quotes, what's inside the bass wants out, Matthews writes. In yet another poem about Mingus, again when Matthews would be only 17, he depicts himself in another New York City nightclub in conversation with Charles Mingus about poetry. When the jazz man reads a poem by the very young budding poet, he gently dismisses its quality. The tone in this other poem seems lighter than in our subject poem, Mingus at the Half Note. Yet, this other poem closes by noting that later that night, while on stage, Mingus fires his pianist mid-number. Since this has happened before, maybe that helps explain why in Mingus of the Half Note there's a twinge in the pianist's shoulder. Does this pianist think he's about to be fired in front of everyone? In our poem, Matthews essentially erases himself, is alert to the various musicians on stage, and shines the spotlight on the face-off between the band leader and the audience member. Let's hear the poem once more, Mingus at the Half Note. 24 bars or so into Better Get It in Your Soul, the band Mossy with Sweat, May 1960 at the Half Note, the rain on the black streets outside, dusted here and there by the pale pollen of the streetlights. Blue wreaths of smoke, the excited calm of the hip in congregation, the long night before us like a view, and Danny Richmond so strung out the drums fizz and seethe. Ho, ho, hold it, Mingus shouts, and the band clatters to fraught silence. There's a twinge in the pianist's shoulder, but this time Mingus focuses like a nozzle, his surge of imprecations on a sleek black man bent chattering across the table to his lavish date. This is your heritage, and if you don't want to listen, then you got someplace else you'd better be. The poor jerk takes a few beats to realize he'll have to leave while we all watch before another note gets played. He glowers dimly at Mingus, like throwing a rock at a cliff, then offers his date a disdained arm, and they leave in single file, she's first, and don't look back nor at each other. "Don't let me constrain you, revelers," Mingus says, and then, tamed by his own rage, for now, he kick-starts the band. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Paul Robeson, Billie Holiday, Charles Mingus, three controversial musicians. You've been listening to Poems for Company, airing every fourth Monday at 9 a.m. and always available online at KMUN.org and various apps. Our theme music is Going to the Sun by Philip Ahlberg from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening.